Welcome to the When Bearing Witness podcast. This podcast is an invitation to explore trauma-informed storytelling, a safe and healthy process of gathering and telling painful stories. It's hosted by me, Maria Bryan, a career storyteller. I have long believed that storytellers play a crucial role in making the world a better place. For a brief moment, I was introduced to the concept of trauma-informed storytelling, and it changed my life. Join my conversations with trauma-informed experts and social good storytellers as we help shape the intersection of trauma-informed care and the storytelling process. Stories are sacred, and we can create safe spaces to tell and share them. Hello and welcome. Today, I'm sharing space with Reverend Dr. Sanghoon Yu, who has had quite the journey as a social worker turned pastor. He is the founder of the Faithful City and Arizona Trauma-Informed Faith Coalition. He's led ministries and social services at Arizona State University and the Phoenix metropolitan area for over three decades. He is leading a trauma-informed movement in the faith space, and I'm so grateful to have this gentle spirit on with us today. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And you have such an interesting intersection of trauma-informed care in the faith community. How did you get there? What was your journey into this intersection?
Well, thank you, Maria, to have me today. Okay. So three decades ago, I was doing social work. My area was trauma and crisis intervention, and it was too heavy. And then I knew I was in calling for being a pastor and working with the young people and all other community work. Meanwhile, I got into my own traumatic season after I worked with congregation, churches, and communities. And actually, we call this a vicarious trauma or secondary trauma. And when you hear the people's story or dealing with the people in the trauma, it affects us. And also, I'm in that my own trauma season. So what happened is that I got into my own deep trauma season where I almost gave up everything. So with the suicidal ideation and all the things, so I almost gave up everything. At that time, I met the trauma-informed care movement when I went to D.C. for a conference. And then in other area, there was a conference going on, trauma-informed congregation conference, which I never heard and thought there's no way mental health and church and pastor and trauma can work together. And so I was very fascinated by that. That was my first time to get into this movement. And so I came back to local area and I got into the leaders here in Arizona. We have our Arizona AACES Consortium. AACES stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. Mm-hmm. And so I joined them and then I started also my faith movement working with them. And it became so viral. So this is about more than 10 years and after I started the movement. But the most important thing is that my healing testimony, where the faith and science really working together, which I thought is not going to happen, but it is really happening and happened in my life. So I work with all other sectors. And so I'm doing the training, not only the churches and other faith communities, but also schools and government and you name it. So with all this development of the movement locally, nationally, here I am today. But of course, this is a grace of God and to me and also a lot of amazing people I've been working together. Sorry, I talk too much. You know, I'm pastor.
You know, I'm a daughter of a pastor, so I I understand and appreciate it. And so I find this fascinating that you were in social work working with trauma and crisis, moved into the faith sector in as a pastor, mm-hmm. and you didn't really get away from trauma and crisis, it sounds like, right? And so you were now living with vicarious trauma while also balancing other lived experiences that you had. And I find it really fascinating that you were doing this 10 years ago, because 10 years ago is really when what were the ACEs studies? Because you're probably more familiar. That was in the 90s.
Yeah, so 1998, it was published in 1998,
Right.
but I don't think it got the real attention. But with all the development of the neuroscience and brain science, it got picked up.
Right.
And so now it's very,
Yeah, I mean it's been slow and fast at the same time, but 10 years ago sounds like you were really on the onset of not just the trauma-informed maybe movement or at least us studying it outside of just what was going on in war or for vets returning, but then very quickly how you were able to bring that into faith-based space. Why is this so important that people are trained to be trauma-informed in the faith-based world?
Well, as you said, 10 years ago, well, 30 years ago, nobody knew what PTSD means. And trauma-informed care was kind of not well recognized. But everything has been shifted since we had the COVID. And we call this collective trauma. So, with trauma is not only just an individual event or matter, and it becomes really global. And with a pandemic era, and we had a racial tension, political tension, so everything really brought up. The good thing is that we don't have to persuade or explain what trauma is. People recognize it. But now, obviously, that if you are a faith leader and have a congregants coming to you, trauma, mental health, substance use, and all these things is not partial issue. A lot of people are suffering from that. So you can see the need on that. And what I hear from faith leaders is like, it's not like we don't want to deal with it, but I don't have any degree in counseling and I'm not familiar with it. So I just don't want to deal with it, not because of I don't want it, but because I don't think I'm capable. So I just don't want to turn them to counselor somewhere else, or we are not equipped for that, we don't have resources. So that's the spot that I'm jumping to. Because I'm doing the movement. So it's not like a kind of a training certificate and you are ready for that. Well, the movement is different. It's like a kind of campaign. I try to equip people so we can build a therapeutic community, although we don't have a therapist. Why I say this? Well, I was in both sides, teaching and counseling and social work and ministering. We can be powerfully therapeutic, although we are not trained for that. So, for example, as you know well, in the trauma world, there is a national phrase, instead of asking what's wrong with you, ask what happened to you. By simply asking what happened to you, you can be really therapeutic. And so likewise. So it's not really about highly trained, certified, credentialed need to build a trauma-informed church, synagogue, mosque, or community, and in faith. We need certain things about the change of our paradigm, perspective, our heart, then you can be actually well equipped to embrace those who are suffering and also helping them to be welcomed and then to have a good foundational space where they feel safe and they're accepted.
I can absolutely imagine being a pastor or a faith-based leader and feeling overwhelmed with I'm tasked with holding space for all of this pain, but I don't have the social work background. I mean, there are two different backgrounds, although there are overlaps. And for me, my background is in marketing and storytelling and journalism. Same kind of thing. I have a lot of training on how to tell a good story. I have no training on how to sit with someone who has experienced the most painful thing in their life, and I'm asking them to tell me that story. So, which is why I just think it's so important that we do two things, which sounds like what you're doing. One, we equip people that aren't social workers and psychologists with the basic tools, but also kind of let them know, and then this is where your boundaries stop, where maybe it's time to pass the torch to, more care and more support than maybe you have the training for. And I think there's room for both to be able to ask questions differently and hold space differently, but also know that, not everyone has the social work background like you do. Like you have both, which is so fascinating to me. What was it like in the very beginning when you were in this movement in Arizona? Take me back to 10 years ago. What were some of the challenges when you were just starting these kind of coalitions and training?
You talk about what was the challenge 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think it's a challenge forever. Whenever I talk about the trauma, right? Everybody says, yeah, we need a healing. Yeah, but as long as we are in this like paradigm of us and them, then I still like, okay, you are in trouble and pain, so I'm going to help you to get rid of it, you know. But what happened is that actually trauma has a very long-term effect than we can think of. So the problem is, okay, I had a wonderful counselor, and then I had a great meeting with a counselor. But, okay, and I came back to work, and I have a boss who doesn't have any idea about the trauma, any the impact or effect. And then I can be re-traumatized very easily by any, well, so to speak, a trigger or activator, right, in the conversation. And it can happen anytime. So what we see is that, why I say the movement, because it's like a fight against racism. We need everybody. We need the whole society that we change the concept and perception is that the mental health and trauma area is not just about this need of more healing, but it comes with a justice issue. It comes with all kind of a connected societal issue, including what we talk about, the racism and everything. So we need to have some kind of comprehensive kind of idea to see the magnitude of this effect of a trauma, mm-hmm. biggest challenge 10 years ago, even today. Because I'm not here that to ask people, you need to be a counselor, you need to be a social worker. Actually, I'm here asking that we are all contributing to this field of trauma-informed care, negatively or positively. Mm-hmm. What side do you want to be in? You know, so that's kind of my position.
This episode was made possible by DonorBox. Let's be honest. Social impact storytelling and fundraising is hard. DonorBox is in your corner to simplify fundraising for you and giving back for your donors. Transform your fundraising strategy effortlessly with DonorBox, the online fundraising platform that streamlines your process, elevates your donations, and ensures a user-friendly experience for your supporters. Create captivating donation forms, accept digital wallet payments, seamlessly track donations, and automate receipts. Joining is a breeze, with no setup or monthly fees and no contracts required. Explore the world of simplified, seamless fundraising at DonorBox.org today. DonorBox, helping you help others. That's really, really powerful to me. That really resonates with me that this isn't a role just for leaders. It almost seems like a no-brainer that if you are a pastor or in a mom that you would have this kind of training. But what I'm learning from you is, no, congregants need this too. Community members and neighbors need this too. Bosses need it and our coworkers need it. Because trauma is so pervasive, especially because you mentioned the pandemic, we've all experienced it in recent history. Mm-hmm. I love this idea of you're on a side. You're like contributing positively or negatively. You can't opt out of the world of trauma. That's very, very powerful to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even the top psychologist and scientist says that how we overcome or recover from trauma, the key word is not the name of the pill or therapy. Mm-hmm. The key word is a relationship. And anybody can contribute to the relationship, how it goes. So I talked about it. It's important how you are accepted, right? Because our movement is all about safety. Although we say, instead of asking what's wrong with you, what happened to you, I always say what happened to you, but we are not interested in the story, but safety first. So I know that you really work hard on that storytelling, right? And I'm all for it. However, before we talk about what happened, we need to make sure we are in the safe ground. Because again, when somebody tells their story, it can also re-traumatize them. by just telling story, right? And also if somebody just listening, like, oh really? Why do you think like that? Why do you, you know, if somebody try to correct, you know, the one, the story itself, that's really detrimental. So we always say connection before correction. So this is anybody can do. You don't need a therapeutic education for this. Just try to, how I can make you feel comfortable with me. Even therapists need to learn about it besides their own degree, because sometimes the therapist and counselors or social workers, sometimes they're very rigorous and they're really demanding, commanding also. Try to correct their clients first. Then they are not trauma-informed therapist. They are not trauma-informed social workers. Whatever position you have or whatever credential you have, it doesn't matter. You just need to have a genuinely have a heart of loving somebody and respecting somebody. That's why there is the place where science and faith are coming together. Because science says safety, kindness, compassion is important. And I was surprised. Whoa, science talk about it? That's what we talk about all the time as a faith community, right? So, wow, I never thought both areas can come together. Here you go. Now, scientists are researching what compassion means, how compassion works. And in a faith community, it's, the compassion is one of the essential virtue we practice. Yeah.
I find this to be so true. And in my world, you know, I had Diana Farias-Henrique on the podcast, and she talks about consent conversations. And she says, we forget this power dynamic that we have when we're asking people to share their story. Start with just being human. Introduce yourself. Say who you are and what your role is and why you're passionate about this nonprofit. And you're exactly right. Sometimes, whatever our role is, we forget to be human. We forget to be compassionate. And sometimes, you're right, it doesn't mean that we need to go get a social work degree. It means we just have to come back to our roots of being human. Mm-hmm. So you have this weave and cleave theme. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So what, you know, as you said, yes, the trauma field came back to me. So to me, it's like, well, that's my destiny. I cannot get out of this. Right? So 30 years ago, even today, everybody says, oh, don't use the word trauma. You know, people don't like it. But I found, well, this is a calling from God for me, so I cannot get rid of it. And 10, 15 years ago, you know, in my ministry, actually, we are very multicultural all the time. And then one of the young guy told me that, hey, Pastor, you're a weaver, because all the time there are so many kinds of people coming together. So, yeah, it's a good word. And then in the Bible, there's several places saying you are a new creation. And then and I got an idea about the cleave. Actually, in the Bible, cleave is kind of a marriage language. When God told Adam and Eve that you are apart from your parents, and then you become a union with your spouse. So cleave is very interesting because it has two sides of the meaning in one word. You are cutting off from the past something, and then you kind of join to a new principle. You make a new union. So to me, that when I say weave and cleave, that we are here, everybody come here, every background with their own painful memories or, you know, success or failure. But however, I want to see that people are going to be cleaved to the new creation, creating the community of belonging, because you belong not because of what you can do, what you cannot do, but because of who you are. So that's actually our foundational motto when we declare the weaving cleave.
That's beautiful. And you do work with diverse cultural backgrounds. How do you adapt? Maybe you don't need to adapt, but how might you adapt your principles and practices of being trauma-informed based on the different cultural backgrounds that you're working with?
When you try to work with people from everywhere, everybody, it's so hard to find a common ground. You know, yeah, I work with the college kids too. So I'm college kids. Okay,
right.
What kind of sports we can do together? What kind of a food we can share? I mean, everything, right? Even the, okay, I live in Arizona, so we use the air conditioning. But some people say it's too cold. Some people say it's too hot. I mean, there's no way of a common ground, a common thing we can find, we can enjoy together. Except the one thing. Everybody loves to be accepted with unconditional love. So to me, it's a trauma-informed care principle, but also this is the only way we can survive if we are multicultural from totally different generations and experiences. So what is common ground here? It's not a uniform. It's not a same food. It's not a, some sports or something event we enjoy together. We do those things. But there are things that everybody just accept immediately and passionate for that, which is unconditional love. And so as long as we can provide unconditional love, there is a humongous possibility we can really weaving people together. And let me tell you, my story is that I'm a pastor, so I'm supposed to know about the unconditional love and practice that every day. But what I found is that I talk about it, but actually I didn't know. So as a pastor, we are in the helping profession. We are in the serious magnitude of self-blame and guilt and shame by ourselves. We don't talk about it, of course. I found when I talk about unconditional love, pretty cool. But when I receive God's unconditional love to me, I become very conditional. And I found, well, that's not the way actually God loves to see, because God want me to love myself because God loves me so that much. And then I can, the next step is I can really love others as God loves me, right? And if I'm not healthy, then how I can love people healthy way? So I always preach, teach, train people that I justify my self-care. Why? Because I want to see everybody's healthy, right? So if I'm not healthy for myself, I cannot help other people healthy way. And that's not going to be healthy.
I, and I'm going to be vulnerable, but I didn't really truly understand unconditional love until I became a mother. And my now 5-year-old, who is both my children, are the loves of my life. And for 2 years, she had this very strong attachment to my husband and rejected me, which is a very developmentally appropriate response. And I learned what it means to have unconditional love, to parent a very young child who has rejected you. And for those who know me very, very deeply, know how difficult those 2 years were for me. So you're right. For many, many years, I've talked about what it means to have compassion, have unconditional love, and I really, really had to put it into practice. And so I think this is something for storytellers listening to really, really reflect on. What does it mean to have unconditional love for the people whose stories you're telling and for your audience members to really, really put them first and love them, even if you maybe disagree with them. And the second part of what you said that really resonates with me is self-love and how you can't, how difficult unconditional love is if you don't heal yourself and have love for yourself, which is, again, one of those things that, like, what does that actually mean? The self-love. But what I hear what you're saying most practically is if we are going to hold space and do our part to heal one another, we have to take care of ourselves. And we started this conversation with you talking about vicarious and secondary trauma. So I want to highlight that part of what you're saying too, how important it is for those of us who are helpers and for those of us who are storytellers to be protective of ourselves and to have unconditional love for ourselves and to take care of ourselves, because it is really, really difficult to receive someone painful and traumatic story if you are broken. And we're all broken, and that's okay. But there are steps that we can take to, have boundaries or just nervous system care and self-care. I think those two that you've said are really beautiful.
Yes, you are absolutely right. because we can actually reach out and help and endure people's story as much as we are healed from ourselves. So I really appreciate when you say, wow, you talk about the mom. Maria, really? You were jealous of your husband because of that? You know? Well, what a beautiful story, because now out of this, you could understand unconditional love. I'm sure you are matured by that, and you can provide, practice more unconditional love to others as well as to yourself. What a beautiful story. That's what is trauma-informed care.
I have one last question for you. What is your vision or hope for trauma-informed care in the faith-based setting?
Resiliency. People are so divided in the same faith, different faith, and social sectors, politics, education, you name it. We're going to come together because we want to be resilient together. That gives people hope. That's what I want to see happen in our faith community, but as well as any other community and sectors all together.
It's a journey, not a destination.
Amen.
Thank you so much for coming on When Bearing Witness. It's been such a joy to listen to your perspective being in this field for so long. And yeah, thank you for sharing this space with me today.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of When Bearing Witness. This podcast was produced by our friends at Rustic Roots. They are video storytellers passionate about sharing the impact of nonprofits. From story ideation to beautiful and powerful videos on screen, they've got you covered. Get in touch over at rusticroots.co. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please do subscribe and leave a rating and review. And remember, your role as a storyteller is making the world a healthier, safer, cleaner, and happier place. Thank you for bearing witness. Until next time.